Good.
Yep, you're good.
You're now live and on the air.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. For the record, my name's George Capatis, and I'm filling in for Chairman Michael Kane. Some quick notes as we begin the meeting. This meeting is being recorded. Before speaking, please state your name so that the transcription service can accurately document today's meeting. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the board. It is open to the public and will run in a manner compliant with RSA 91-A. Meeting materials for the board and the public can be found by visiting the Department of Business and Economic Affairs website. We have a number of items to work through today in a short time frame. You'll find these items on the agenda with your enclosed supportive documents. The agenda and the documents have been provided to the board electronically. Printed copies are available today, and all materials were available to the public via the BIA website. Joe, would you please call the roll?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Albert.
Here.
Thank you. Jim Alden. Joseph Alexander. Kevin Avard. Rick Bartle. Christine Brennan.
Here.
Thank you. Anya Brzezinski. Kelly Clark. Kenneth Clinton.
Here.
Thank you. George Capatis.
Here.
Thank you. Bruce Crocheter, Mary Crowley, Tyler Eaton.
Here.
Thank you. Patrick Fall.
Here.
Thank you. Chase Hageman.
Here.
John Hennessy. Michael Kane is absent. Justin Cantor. Shane Long.
Here.
Thank you. Donnelly Lozo.
Here.
Thank you. Lorianne Lundgren.
Here.
Thank you. Larry Major.
Here.
Thank you. Ashok Patel. Jim Prue. Shannon Reed.
Here.
Thank you. Tim Sink. Gary Thomas. Mr. Chairman. Oh. Perfect. Richard Sala.
How you doing?
Good.
Good to see you in person.
You are present. So, Mr. Chairman, we have, and Mr. Sala's letter came in earlier, so he is appointed by the governor, and so we have a quorum, just barely, so please nobody go to the bathroom in groups.
Nobody can leave. Lock the doors. Now we have some people back here. Could you just all introduce yourselves to the group, please?
Jim Romberg, I'm the Workforce Development Administrator with New Hampshire DOT.
O'Brien's on the Training Development Manager for New Hampshire DOT.
Thank you. The meeting minutes from the June meeting are found in your packet. Any errors, corrections, or omissions? If not, I'll entertain a motion to approve.
Sir?
Motion made.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Oppose? Abstain?
Abstain.
Okay. Motion carries. Again, welcome everyone. Let's keep it moving. We'd like to take a moment if anyone from the public would like to provide a public comment. If so, please state your name for the record prior to the meeting. And if anybody from the public that wants to offer anything. Okay. We start our agenda here today with some informational items. Staff will not be presenting. Rather, they will be answering any questions you may have. Joe, could you please guide us through these items?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we have, as we like to provide to the board, briefings and opportunities for interaction with our various subrecipients about the different programs that we have. We're really grateful that All Youth Count and Easter Seals could join us here today to talk about the program that we're using with governor's discretionary dollars that the board approved a while back. I think that you're going to figure out how meaningful and impactful this program has been in just a short amount of time. So I'd like to introduce the folks from Easter Seals and All Youth Count to take it away.
Beautiful. Thank you very much, Joe.
My name is Ben Adams. I'm with Easter Seals, New Hampshire. I'm a senior director of programs. Really fortunate to work with All Youth Camp, or AYC, which is the program that I'm going to talk about today.
I'm Thomas Ware. I'm the program coordinator for All Youth Camp.
Beautiful. Sorry, we don't do super polished presentations, but we're going to try to get you all of the appropriate information you need so you can hopefully realize kind of the impact this program has. So we've got some basic slides to kind of structure and walk through. So Thomas, you want to run through the first few?
Sure. All right. Well, I'm not just going to read from it. I'll just see if I can expound a little bit on the bullet points there in the slide. We were established a couple of years ago. We had a couple of gentlemen come to Easter Seals with a problem statement saying that, hey, we've identified a gap in service. And that gap was after youth age out of the foster system from DCYF, they are really starting to kind of fall between the cracks. They're at risk for a whole host of negative outcomes, anything from like homelessness, substance misuse, incarceration, suicide, all those negative things. So what about creating a program to work with those youth? So they are aging out of the foster care system, and they can try to navigate the community resources that are out there that exist, but there's really not a program that was providing kind of wraparound case management or care coordination for those youth. So we decided to create All Youth Count to meet that need. So what that looks like, go to the next one. We provide individualized support and care coordination. So what that looks like is myself or my staff, care coordinator, working one-on-one with you, meeting them wherever they are. And that can be like in person, over the phone, it can be on a video chat, figuring out what their needs are, what their problems are, what they're facing, and then, okay, what can we do to help? And typically, kind of the main lanes that we work in, we want to try to find some good housing, safe, stable housing, which is a very significant challenge, as I'm sure you're all aware. And then the second lane is employment, like meaningful employment. Hopefully not just going and grabbing a job anywhere, but let's steer these youth towards career paths. And then the third piece, we can provide emergency financial system assistance, what we call like flex funds. And those come in really handy because these youth, without a support system, a natural family support system, they're really kind of out on their own. So maybe they're working, and then when they do finally find an apartment, they're living hand to mouth or paycheck to paycheck, so they don't have enough money saved up for the first month's rent, security deposit. That's where our funds can really help out. We step in.
And this financial assistance is key. Sorry, Thomas. Just like real examples, last week, $27, somebody would have been evicted. $27. They couldn't go get it anywhere. We can pay that to make sure that they secure housing. Another use, the apartment's all ready to go. I need $63 for an application. If you don't have that, you don't get into the apartment. Even though your voucher's been cleared, the housing provider says, yeah, you're a good fit, no $63, on to the next. So this financial assistance, those are small examples, but it's really important and like central to the program.
Right, so when we launched the program, we decided that obviously we need to work with the state agency that oversees the foster system. Right? They know these youth, they've got established relationships, they're going to be able to send us those referrals. Hey, we're working with this youth, or they're connected to us by a kind of aftercare assistance, so we know this youth could really use your help. So we piloted the program in partnership with their Concord office. Since then, we've expanded throughout basically all of Southern New Hampshire, parts of the Lakes region, just expanded to where the sea goes as well. As I mentioned, we had a couple gentlemen come to us with the initial problem statement to help create the program. They then went out and connected with people from a variety of different industries and around the state town to put together an advisory council. They've been helping us raise funds before we were able to get the governor's grant, discretionary funds. And then they also, you know, hopefully leverage their connections to landlords, business owners, people around the state who can then, we can then go to and say, all right, we've got a youth who is interested in becoming an LNA, or they're interested in whatever it is. Let's see if somebody has a connection to a business owner or a connection to a training program, so we can leverage the council's networks that way. We may be able to do that for, like I said, for jobs, for housing, and make connections to property management companies, to landlords around the state. We go to them on the front end instead of saying going through the standard process of like finding an apartment on Zillow or online or wherever you can find them these days. And that can be anything from like Craigslist to Facebook, all that. But instead, we go directly to that landlord and say, all right, we've got a youth who's homeless, or she needs a place for the end by the end of this month or next month. Do you have something that might work? It's a great connection to that.
Yeah. So we jumped over it in a previous slide, but essentially this advisory council represents the private sector. So this is a public-private partnership. We know we've got DCYF at the table, right? They're a public sector partner. And then we have various private sector partners who represent housing, as Thomas said, like a range of interests. And so that's the leverage that we can access to get preferential treatment for some of these youth. I mean, I don't mean that in a pejorative way. If you're coming up and you've got mom and dad, and you go to college and you come out, maybe mom and dad knows somebody, and they can hook you up with something that's going to help you make progress in your life. These kids don't have that. So none of these kids raised their hand and said, hey, I would love to end up in foster care. You know, it wasn't a choice of their own. So coming out with no supports, where they've been basically wrapped with centralized supports, high control over their life, they come out and all of a sudden it's like navigate this landscape of very diffuse supports. So we used to get you everything at DCYF. Now go to these five entities to get it. These kids aren't equipped to do that. I'm not going to say all of them can, but the majority of them can. So that's where this kind of care coordination model comes in. The next few slides are going to look at like demographics and outcomes. So before we go to that, any questions about the second program?
How big is that advisory council?
I think we've got 20 members, maybe 10 to 12 show up every meeting, kind of like a rotating cast. But the key is those 12 members, 16 members, and then their Rolodex, right? So if we made an appointment ask to the council, they can think about who they know and leverage their contact. Yeah, I'm going to ask you guys later on. So these are just basic demographics. In this packet, these demographics and outcomes are a little bit stale. Behind this general program review, this is a report that we submit to Joe, Lisa, and Melissa every month, and you can get some more updated information there. But this is just to give you kind of an idea of the outcome capacity that we have as an organization to say, this is what we're doing with the kids. Because it's great to say we provide program coordination and care coordination. Well, what happened? Like, what are the outcomes? So as an agency, we're really focused on showing what those are. So at this point in time, this I think was quarter one, we have 35 participants. You can see mostly Hillsborough, Alameda County. Of these participants, we can look what services they have accessed. 19 ADS funds, 35 supportive services, 7 were in post-program support. So when you discharge, you're not just totally discharged. You stay kind of on an inactive caseload for 6 months in case something pops up. Gender breakdown there, age of the participants were broken down there.
And I don't think I mentioned the age population we serve. Can be as young as 14, and then up to 27th,
like 18th, you can see from that average age, that kind of a wheelhouse is that like 18 to 20. What drives Hillsborough and Merrimack to have higher numbers than the rest of the market? What do you think drives
So as Thomas noted, we piloted. So DCYF, they know exactly what they have in service, right? And they've got a pretty good idea who's going to age out without being reunified with a biological family member or being formally adopted. So they said, hey, our Concord office is where that's a real issue. So the first year we piloted with them, right? And that's when we geographically located our staff. Then when we decided to expand, we said, we'll take youth from any office, but the goal is they want to live kind of along the I-93 corridor out in the woods. So we're saying, hey, you could be way up in Coos County, but if your goal is to live in Manchester, Nashua, Portsmouth, out to the lakes region, Tilton, Franklin, we'll take you.
Are those same services available in the other counties that don't have members out there?
No, currently no. And so that's
so built around the services that are provided, and then they move into that territory.
I'm sorry, say that again.
So you've got the services available right there.
Yeah.
So that's where the folks go, as opposed to having services in Crawford County.
Yeah.
They're not going to go there because there aren't any services.
Okay. Yeah. And that's they're coming for this service, which is again a pilot program under this funding. And again, a lot of it's like where the housing and the jobs are.
Right.
You know.
Okay. Hi. Trying to say my name before.
If you could.
Chase Hageman from BEA. Just, I may be getting the cart before the horse because you may be heading there now. So if that's the case, just brush me off and say we're getting there. But I'm looking at the quarterly report, and the case management number is 1288. The intake is 30. So what's the distinction there? What makes someone in case management versus some kind of full intake for this program?
So case management are individuals that we're actually working with. And then intake are kids who are in the pipeline, we're chasing paperwork. They've got to do their due diligence and fill out the forms. Ideally, they're attached to a case manager at DCYF who also can give us some information so we know who we're working with, where they currently are, and where we're trying to get them to.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yeah.
You have a nice breakdown. I think I saw a slide that was starting to go that direction, but a question I had going into it, Youth with Housing Goal at assessment period as a point of reference. The intake is 28. 12 months out, you're tracking 8. Does that mean that 20 individuals have rolled out of the program, no longer in the program? How does that, what's that meant to reflect?
All right, yeah, so we're going to get into this. So so basically, everything's based on assessments, right? The youth completes an assessment based upon their experience, and then Thomas and his team, they do an assessment based upon the youth assessment and the referral source assessment, right? So everything's pegged to a Likert scale. So we can see this 5-point Likert scale over here, right? So right here we're talking about education. Red is bad, green is good, right? At red, we're not currently enrolled in secondary education. 2, currently enrolled in secondary. 3, graduated, completed some secondary. 4, now we're really taking that step because we're talking about education relates to employment. We're trying to get more education and training so we can get that better job. And then 5 is they've completed that. So when we measure this, we need some time to work with these kids. So we are only reporting out on a youth who's been in program for 9 months, right? So of the youth who have been in the program for 9 months, we can see where they are intake all the way through discharge.
Okay.
And so this one's education, it's important, but as we can see, employment, you know, is the focus of this group. So it's the same thing, you know, we're looking intake through discharge, we're only looking at youth who have been in program assessed for 9 months, and so we can see the color shows it, but then also some breakdowns below here that let you know, key. 60% are working at goal hours. Like, that's important. 80% they're employed, which is great. But if you're employed and you're not working at great hours, that's not the best. So we're proud of 80% working, but 60% working at goal hours is even better. I know we're talking about employment today, but social determinants of health, hard as hell to have a job if you don't have a place to stay, right? So the fundings for workforce for employment, we've got to address housing. And this is one that we're really proud of. So this scale is always going to be different for every one of these performance indicators. So we might be living dark blue 3. We're living in safe housing, but we're uncertain of our future. That's not great. If we're safe today, we may not be safe tomorrow. But that's better than temporary or substandard housing. 4, we're living in safe housing. It's adequate for our needs. oh, I'm sorry, we're living in safe housing, but it's inadequate for our needs. So maybe I'm a father, I've got a young child, I'm in a studio. I'm housed, I'm not homeless, that's great, but it is inadequate because it'd be great to have a bedroom, you know? And then five is the goal, living in safe housing that's adequate for their needs. And at discharge, currently, we're batting 100%. That doesn't mean next quarter we might think be down to 80%, 20%, because the kids are rolling through. So, any questions on, like, the outcomes, the metrics? Excellent. So here's the last slide, Thomas.
Well, yeah, I mean, like I mentioned earlier, we're always looking for new council members, and then connections to landlords is a big one. So if anybody has connection to landlord, property company, apartments, housing, new housing, you know, it's a good place to live. It's going to be safe and somewhat affordable. So yeah, if you have any of those connections, please find a way to get in touch with us. Or if you want to get involved and you can help, more than happy to have you on board.
And then in the longer report, you'll see there's some note of supportive employers. Those are employers who have met with Thomas or myself. We've explained the population, we've explained the goal, and they've said, yeah, we're willing to go above and beyond to make sure that that youth is successful here. Knowing that it might be a little different than your normal direct hire, they might need a bit more support from a peer or a mentor. You might have to roll through a few more bumps in the road than you would. So if any of you are or know of an employer that would be a good fit to be a supportive employer, that would be excellent as well. Any other questions?
Where are you on the agenda?
We're on 2A, we're doing well. Excuse me. We're on 2A.
Thank you all for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you.
In our community.
Thanks. Okay, Joe, would you continue with grab a response update?
Good work.
Thanks, guys.
So, and this is page 23 of your packets. Item 2B is a rapid response update, and I'll kick it over to Jimmy Hinson.
Hi, I'm Jimmy Hinson. I'm with the New Hampshire Department of Business and Economic Affairs Office on Workforce Opportunity, and also the current State of New Hampshire Dislocated Workers and Administrator. As we transition into our second quarter of this year, we're currently on track with rapid responses at a pace of where we were this time last year. We documented 21 at the time of this report, and which is two more than where we were this time last year. The one nice part is the number of people affected is lower. Impacting 987, which is still high, but the industries that are impacted are logistics, retail, pharmacy, higher education, healthcare, insurance, hospitality, and manufacturing. I can quickly say most of this is just massaging the workforce and cutting back where they can. We are continuing to do in-person rapid response sessions with very limited Zoom conferences when necessary. With our expanding workforce of people working from home, sometimes Zoom is really the only option to reach everyone. We've had two individuals come on board with the Business and Economic Affairs, new business resource specialists that have received training. In fact, we've done all. We did retraining again with that with Chase and his team. Really happy with the progress that they're making. And we are continuing to go out and visit the NH Works offices when we're available. And just within the last 2 months, we've been able to visit the NH Works office in Nashua, Portsmouth, Manchester, Berlin, and Conway. A lot of the message that we like to send from Joe and myself is we appreciate the work they're doing in and around administering the WIOA Dislocated Worker Program. that is targeting people who are being laid off and getting them into employment and training opportunities. Last thing I will say, one thing that I'm really, really happy about is we've been doing a lot more job fairs in conjunction with a lot of these layoffs. And it's not uncommon. In fact, the Associated Buyers, which will be closing at the end of March, I'm pretty confident we've already got everybody jobs within the surrounding area. So using our partnership with Employment Security and businesses in the surrounding area and our team at BEA, it's really good to see that. And you can see the stress on the people's face just kind of melt off when they get that kind of help. That concludes my report.
Okay. Joe, could you continue, yeah, please?
Any questions for Jimmy? Is that okay to ask?
Yeah.
Great.
No questions.
Awesome. Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're going to go to 2C, which is a financial update. A few things, and that starts on page 24. So just wanted to highlight, we are missing a member of our team. Barbara Shea retired at the end of January. We're devastated to see her go. So Lisa and I will tag team the fiscal portion. So looking forward to any tough questions that we won't be able to answer. So she retired to become a full-time grandmother. Her son and granddaughter live down in North Carolina, where I'm told the weather today is 60 degrees and sunny. So,
we're not far off.
Yeah, right.
No difference.
It's a bittersweet loss, but we'll be welcoming Melissa Carter, who currently works at the Department of Business and Economic Affairs. So she'll be starting this Friday. So we had kind of our own Operation Warp Speed to fill that spot. So we'll be introducing you to her at the June meeting. So I just wanted to highlight that. We were hoping that. I tried to convince Barb to stay on a little longer, especially to get through one more board meeting, but North Carolina was calling. So, excuse me, Lisa and I will happily answer any questions. You know, the report is in front of you with the different spreadsheets that we have attached. If I can just mention, for those who have been on the board for a while, you kind of see a difference between the total dollars. You'll remember that during COVID and the years kind of post-COVID, we received additional funding from U.S. Department of Labor because of our increased unemployment rate. We're normally a minimally funded state, which means we get the same amount of money as the state of Vermont and Wyoming, which makes total sense, even though we have in Vermont double the population and way better performance metrics, just saying, and enrollments and whatnot. But so you'll see that those numbers kind of more normalize and whatnot. So I just wanted to highlight that we didn't lose money from anything that we did wrong. It's just a normalization of that. So I wanted to highlight that because I did get a question about that from somebody. So any questions on 2C that we can try to answer?
No questions. Can we move on to 2D?
Thank goodness. All right, 2D. I'm going to kick that over to Lisa for a performance update. Take it away, Lisa.
Hi, so Michelle, performance update. 2D is your performance update. We Our performance, we're kind of trending the same way we always do, where we meet most of our performance, meet or exceed them across the Title I program. The one that is always kind of the outlier is measurable skill gains. That is a year-long performance measure, so we add to it each quarter. So that one always looks bad at the beginning of the year, and then by the end of the year, we kind of bring it all up. But for the most part, performance is going relatively good. We had some struggles, especially in measurable skill gains and credential attainment, and that has a lot to do with turnover of new staff. How we feel at the subrecipient level, and we've been actively working on trying to do some more technical assistance with with them so that they understand all of the ways that they can count their activities toward these new measures. But that's kind of where we're at for Title I. You have the Title III and IV measures in there as well.
Okay. Any questions, anybody? If not, we'll move on to 2E.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So 2E, we work with our partners at Employment Security quite a bit for a number of things, including looking at economic and labor information. The Economic Labor and Market Information Bureau, or ELMI, sends us a report every 2 years about essentially like cost effectiveness of WIOA. So I wanted to highlight, because you know, not bad for a government program, but, and I can provide the report if you want, but I copied and pasted from Brian Gottlob's report, that WIOA programs, the conclusion at the bottom in bold, WIOA programs produce approximately $2 of economic activity output in the state for every $1 of program expenditures, which, if I can just say, not bad for government work. Normally we're saying it's very much inverse. I do want to mention it used to be about $3 of the 2 years prior, and I wanted to highlight that because there's a number of members on the board. We have the dollar, frankly, isn't what it used to be, and just the difference between the past few years. But also, too, costs have skyrocketed, with the exception of the community college program, community college system. If I just do a quick shout out, who have kept tuition the same for how many years?
Nearly a decade.
So we appreciate that and appreciate you. But we see the especially with CDL trucking, with the private providers going from like about 7,000 to upwards of 12,000. So it just kind of is what it is. But also too, and I don't know if Lisa or Melissa wanted to chime in from the programmatic side of things, we are spending more on supportive services. And people are in you know, some really tough spots. So you know, we frequently go above the 1500 cap and try to meet the need whenever possible. It's part of our goal to not send anybody away, no wrong door, and to serve the individual. So I wanted to kind of couch all that, because we've, from a board, you gave us the direction to really kind of be aggressive, and we're doing that. So, and I just want to highlight a little good news too. So happy to take any questions. And I can provide the individual report if you'd like it in full.
Can I just add, this is Lisa Drab of Opportunity. Joe is absolutely right. The amount of money that we spend on training now versus a couple of years ago has gone up through the roof. One, we're also have more individuals enrolled in our programs due to our ability to expand the eligibility, especially for our adult program. So that's really all kind of factored into all of these things. But the cost of living, the support services that we do provide, they're much needed and much counted on for people to get through our training programs, because during the time that they're in training, they still have to live. They still have to pay their bills. They still have to get through the daily, you know, daily life. So we often do, with the labor process, go above our $1,500 in labor and support services cap. And I don't know that that's going to change anytime soon. We are spending a lot more money and enrolling more individuals than we're spending more money in training. We have a lot more training providers on our list than we did a couple years ago, a lot more online training providers. And those costs, you know, have all risen across the board. CDL is a perfect example. We do not have a local provider in the state of New Hampshire that does CDL training from beginning to end, so classroom and road, all in one fell swoop. So we are sending people to Massachusetts and Vermont, other than White Mountain Community College, which does have their training program. But for all the rest of the folks on kind of the other side of the state, we're sending them down to Massachusetts to do their training, and we're spending exorbitant amounts of money in mileage and reimbursement. Because that's a long way for somebody from Concord to drive, or even from Plymouth or other areas. So, you know, we're doing the best we can. We're looking at other alternatives for CDL in particular, but the cost of everything has just gone up. And, you know, the fact that we kept this relatively good, $2 for every dollar that we spend in the WIOA, I think that's testament to all the things that we're doing at the state.
Shannon?
Shannon Gray from the Community College System. sense of how many people you are funneling to out of state CDL programs and where they're generally located, the people in the programs?
Yes. Yeah, and we kind of calculated that, and we had conversations with community colleges to try and get that license into like one of the more centrally located locations. But we have all that data, and we're showing outcomes, and the outcomes are good, and where the areas of the state that we're looking for to kind of get that CDL training. I know Department of Transportation has CDLs. It's a matter of getting that whole classroom component and the and on the road, which is really difficult. We have some providers that have reached out, that we reached out to them, that are approved training providers, but they don't want to be on our list because of the requirements that U.S. Department of Labor puts on us for performance measures. We are actively trying to work with the smaller CDL training providers to explain what the requirements are and how it really isn't as big a lift as it might seem. So hopefully we'll be able to, we're working right now with some of the authorities, and hopefully we'll get them on our list, so at least it gives us somebody. But that's kind of, that's one sticking point we've had for almost a year and a half with CDL. Can we take a question from the public? I don't know what the rules are.
Sure.
Jim Rovely, DOT. Just to let you know, we do have CDL drivers, but we recognize that there's been a problem with the training and with the Windows Sailing Conference shutting down. We've actually started a program, so we will train somebody through the classroom and on the road. So.
And sorry, and I believe that we have been funneling people to be employed at the Department of Transportation to get their CDL to kind of not only help Department of Transportation because they're new CDL drivers, but they'll do the training. So if we know somebody who's interested in CDL, we can kind of work it both ways. So I think that our programs are doing kind of like a reverse engineering of people.
Yep.
Thank you.
Can I ask a clarifying question on that? So the program at DOT, is that open to anyone in the public who wants the certification, or only DOT hires?
Only DOT hires.
Okay.
So that's why our, like, if we have a participant that's unemployed that wants to be a CDL driver and we can put them into a training program, we can refer them to DOT to look at the hiring process, which then gives DOT the employees, but also gets the training for the individual. So
sorry,
that kind of worked. We're working backwards or forwards or sideways. I don't even know at this point.
And for the record, that was Chase Hageman. Thank you.
Donald Roosevelt, I'm just wondering if, as DOT is doing this work, if you would consider partnering with municipalities so that they get CDL drivers too. So you train the part, the municipality works with you, I mean, because it benefits, you know, the whole state when you work like that. Is that a possibility in the future?
We've had conversations about it.
But currently with our major rates, we're not able to accommodate that.
Yeah. Yeah. You're filling your shop parcel.
Yeah. Once we're
full. Okay. Other questions? Anybody? If not, Joel can. I'm sorry. Mike?
Part of the issue has got to be that you.
And just name. Yep. Sorry.
One of the issues is that folks have to get to the place of training. And then you got to pay their mileage. There's no housing available. So they're going to go up north to the White Mountains Community College and they got to find a place to live. Same place with any place you put in the state. So you're not going to get a statewide participation in CDL.
Yeah.
The community college could get that license into all 7 locations. That could really be helpful.
But then there's the investment of materials, and, you know, 18-wheelers, and everybody's got to be there, and then the trainers and all that stuff. So there's a huge cost to that.
I imagine some of the training units for simulation.
It has been in the past, but know, VR training with the new wave. They're doing VR training for welding and plumbing and all the different types of trades. So it could be something that we look at in the future. We are looking at an option of there's online classroom trainers online that we are relatively cheap. If a participant is able to do that kind of online training, and you can have the, you know, the study skills and things like that, we're going to hopefully look at, you know, other ways in our policy for the eligible training provider to, because we're in such a crisis in this area, is there a way to add that kind of course to our list and then try to find a training provider that will do the on-the-road portion? So send them, you know, get the classroom and then do the on-the-road. We've heard that there's some out there that would be willing to do the on-the-road portion.
Chase
Hageman, I know you use CDL as kind of the example of costs going up and having a limited training ability. And we all know that everyone needs CDL drivers, but is there actually a high level of interest in getting that kind of training?
Huge.
Okay.
It's a huge interest. Not only in our adults program, which is 18 up, but we have a huge interest in our youth population for our out-of-school youth that are 18 to 24. So they're really looking at this as a career pathway because the CDL driver, you know, you get in, and then you can add certifications and different trainings. It's just like any other career pathway. And they start, you know, at a relatively high rate of pay. So there is a lot of interest. It's just the one that right now is our sticking point as far as the training and the providers because it is, you know, the hands-on hand. We had a meeting quite a while ago with a bunch of the workforce development directors, I think, and I don't know where it went from that. I think we feel the stuff that everybody needed to do and get to go forward. Thanks. Thank you.
Dr. O'Brien, DOT. I use Moodle, so we're looking at doing that more so for the upgrades, so from like E to A, but that is a good tool that we've used a lot that we're looking at developing right now to help out with that issue. We only have one CDL trainer for the entire state, so we struggle with that because we can only have a maximum of 6 individuals in our training, so right now we're looking at April. We've looked at the VR stuff, and you can use it as a really good tool, so I've actually talked to a lot of other DOTs that are using it. It's an excellent, excellent tool, and even federal regulations won't allow you to actually use it as the behind the wheel skills training, but it is an excellent tool to use for the guys throughout the day to get the free trip experience and how to get a feel for the truck. So
I would love to. Yeah.
Absolutely. Definitely.
Okay. Anything else, anybody? If not, Joe, can we continue? Yeah,
absolutely. So 2F, we won't go through the success stories individually. You know, we always put them in the packet for you to read. Again, we put a lot of data at you in terms of performance data, financial data, but these are the kind of the stories that come with it, the human element, if you will. So that's from page 30 to page 59 in your packet. These are very compelling stories. You know, please, you know, if nothing else, take a look at these because this is kind of why we do the things that we do. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take any questions or move on to item 3A.
Any questions, anybody? Okay, if not, let's move on to item 3A.
Great. So item 3A is, so a few members of the board who've been on for quite a while, talking with Mike Albers before the meeting, been on the board, I think, for at least one other state plan iteration. So the combined state plan is something that we have to do every 4 years. We have to develop a new plan that has to be put into a web portal and approved by U.S. Department of Labor and Education every 4 years. And then, 2 years in, we then have to work to revise said plan and update that, which is just as bureaucratic and as cumbersome as you might imagine. So, for those who are at the last meeting in October, we did a brainstorming session where we had round tables. It was very more discussion oriented to talk about goals, strategy to move forward. So today we're going to look for a vote to approve the state plan, which was sent out as Attachment A. I have it in a gigantic binder here, which is quite big. If you're having trouble sleeping at night, highly recommend, especially the state plan. Better than a warm glass of milk. But we thought we would focus a little bit more on this pink handout that everybody should have. It was sent out today too. But it talks about the goals that are set forward, because a lot of the document is a policy document and a compliance document, but we really kind of wanted to pull out for any substantive conversation about the goals and strategies, because you as a board decided those back in October. So that's kind of what will guide, and all joking aside, will help us as staff implement your vision and work on that to guide our decisions every day. So if you look at the pink paper, you'll see strategy 1.1, goal 1, develop and implement a comprehensive workforce system by aligning workforce, education, and economic development investments. Any questions about that or the strategies? I mean, you'll see them listed there as well. Okay. Goal 2 is enhance accessibility and outcomes of the workforce system by leveraging technology and data. Yeah.
Chase Hageman. You know, I just was curious. I'm sorry I missed the October meeting. This being sort of the high-level strategy document, are there any next steps for, like, action plans for specific strategies in here and how that would all play out?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, as staff, we want to look, this will help us guide decision-making when it comes to new sources of funding that we will chase after to apply for federal grants, what meetings and conversations we need to have, what new partners we need to bring, but also using our discretionary dollars, you know, how do we use those effectively to implement these goals and strategies and whatnot. So it's, you know, a lot of this, you know, I've told the feds, if we could get this down to 100 pages, I think that's fair, but 328, I think it is.
I think without appendices.
Yeah, without the appendices, you know. But, you know, this is kind of the meat and potatoes of what we're going to be focused on.
Thank you.
And also, too, if I can add, you know, think about, you know, all of you have been appointed. We have this fun little formula, you know, about certain agencies being on, certain nonprofits, certain partners, businesses. You know, think about how you all kind of play into all these different goals. Goal 3 is provide access to a continuum of high-quality education, training, and career pathway opportunities that will attract and retain businesses and employees. Goal 4, support business and job seeker growth through workforce practices that promote diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. And then last but not least, goal 5, execute an industry-led strategy to meet employer needs and establish a pipeline of skilled workers for future demand. And you can again see the strategy. So I just wanted to read the goals. These were developed together with Grace and the team from Thomas P. Miller and Associates. And we're happy to take any questions on the goals, strategies, direction. Any questions?
I'm sorry.
Richard Sowell, Director of Vocational Rehabilitation. I have questions about Goal 4. Maybe it's in the line document, I just don't see it, but the larger plan define what we mean. I have a couple of questions. So I guess one is, does it define what we mean by diversity, equity,
I'd have to re... I think it's about more about access, correct me if I'm wrong, Lisa, it's more about access that anybody who wants to join our programs can do so. It's about not turning anybody away, you know, and certainly we, you know, if somebody has a mansion on Hampton Beach and pulls up in an Audi, you know, we look at the kind of the income sort of deal, but, you know, the goal here is that we welcome everybody into the programs and work to make it work, frankly. So, and that, you know, from your world, working with folks with disabilities, you know, from the VIP perspective, the VIP program that we have, looking at working with historically marginalized communities, some new Americans, refugees being a lot of the work that's being done on that with our partners from the International Institute of New England. Certainly Southern New Hampshire Services has a part of the contract too. But we're trying to just, you know, ensure that our programs are open and accessible to everybody.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Lori Lundergan. So I will say that the last meeting, that exercise was vastly helpful to not only understand what the group is doing, but where we can make an impact. Are there plans in the near future to offer similar opportunities for our involvement to help achieve the goals that we've set, more particularly as more brainstorming sessions, network diving in, kind of all those follow-up activities?
We haven't done anything like that in the past, but if that's something that the board would like, we're happy to accommodate that.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if others found it as enlightening or kind of exciting, but to really start feeling the impact, I felt like it was a really great opportunity to see how we all played into what's going on and how we continue that impact.
Good point.
Just a thought.
Very good point.
Is it okay to ask the
sure?
Would just, you know, kind of just wondering if we could, is there interest for that from the board so that we can try to plan out and map out the next few meetings?
Chase
Hageman. I'm definitely open to something like that, but I would want to have a sort of defined scope of what you're wanting from the board and how we can actually play a role, since you're the staff on the ground doing the program. You know, what would be the appropriate place for our input and how would we execute it? Basically, what would be helpful?
Others? I'm sorry. Shannon?
Shannon Reed from the English Institute. Would it be helpful, I mean, this happens anyway, but since these are the goals that we kind of crystallized through the brainstorming session last fall, to periodically get a report or a report out or an update on how you feel we're progressing through these goals, rather than kind of reinvent or us dive deeply, and I feel like this is a good for your work. And it might be helpful for us to see how how it's going, and what else you might need from this group of stakeholders or any other folks that are involved in these efforts.
Yeah. Lisa Dry with OL. I think we could definitely incorporate that into an informational item. Once the plan's approved, you know, this is our draft, and you all will vote on it to approve it as it is, but then the process is that U.S. Department of Labor and Department of Education and all the entities that review it will review the plan, and once it's in the portal, and make recommendation changes. So the process will go back and forth for quite a while until we get an actual finalized, approved plan. But I think we could incorporate the goals into some informational items, maybe not every goal for every meeting, but maybe highlight this is the work that we've done this past however many months it's been since we met on these goals, and this is some examples of what we've done. I think we could definitely incorporate that.
Yeah, I asked if some of these are fairly specific-ish deliverables, and it would be interesting if are you able to move forward on them? Do you have the resources that you need? If not, what might be done to provide those? You know, maybe, just the very first thing in goal one is the awareness campaign about in-demand career pathways, that would be interesting to see, are you able to do something like that? Do you have partners who can step up and help you, et cetera?
And this is kind of the direction and feedback that we really appreciate and like. You know, the goals in the past were not developed in a way that led to a lot of board interaction and deliverables. So we were very, I think, specific with our request to TPMA to kind of focus the conversation on giving us goals that are actually attainable and strategies to help get us there. Because again, this document largely sits on the shelf for 2 years. I say largely, there's some good stuff usually in the beginning, like most, you know, reports in the end. But so we want to try to leverage this more than we've ever done before to make it a living document.
We definitely want it to not sit on the shelf. We want to pull it down. We want to, you know, really make sure that we're using it as a working document. And we're pretty clear with the contractors that we didn't want it to just be check off the box if it's a compliance issue. We wanted it to be something that we as workforce development within the state could really utilize as our roadmap for the next 4 years. And I think with your help at that last session, like, you all came up with these goals, these strategies. Whether you remember, like, being the bad words, yes, we didn't come up with that. That's why we contracted with TPMA, but you all came up with them. So I think, you know, we can definitely take this and move it forward into something that we could really use as an office, as a staff, to give us that roadmap to where we need to go. And then also to incorporate what we need from the board, what we need from partners, what we need to get to the next level to accomplish that strategy.
Chase
Eggman. I am in no way advocating for the bare minimum, but I do, as someone who's familiar with federal reporting and running programs like this, I want to be careful with what we're sort of making the team do. So I'm all for getting updates and progress reports, but I'm open to us receiving that in the easiest path possible or method for you as you're moving forward, so you're not just churning out reports and presentations unnecessarily.
Yeah. It, Joe Dorian, for the record, thank you. And, you know, but I think it's you know, what Lori mentioned and what you mentioned, I think we can bridge that gap and really make something happen, because I think it's worth the meeting last time, I think, was my favorite that we've had, because it was great seeing a lot of interaction and engagement and whatnot. So, you know, we'll work to find a good happy medium and try to make something like that happen, that it has low administrative burden. Thank you for that, Chase.
Yeah, George Capatis, Employment Security, and if there's anything you need from us as far as a resource, we're more than willing to step up to the plate and help with that as well.
Thank you.
You unfortunately know where I am as well.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add to that, but I would agree that this is a lot of information. And the 377 pages with your, just so you know, because I was looking for the diversity question, but I think that in order for the board to really feel like they're part of something, right, that why are we here? That last meeting, you're right, I think people felt like that, right? I'm telling you my experience, And so without it being too heavy of a lift, it's kind of nice to bridge the way that you're talking about for us to know that, hey, come to the next meeting prepared for ideas about how you think this could work, or who you think could be a partner in something, or, you know, whatever it is, so that you come to the meeting with a little bit of something you can bring to the table or learn from somebody else. And, you know, I've been involved with the workforce board almost as long as a commissioner, right, in the 90s, when it started, was it WEA and then WEO and then WEO? And I think that every board gets stuck in a place where they don't know what they're bringing. And if you feel like you do know, then I think your attendance changes and your activity conversation changes, right? So you check off all the boxes, but then you have a... So I, you're heading in the right direction. These board meetings have been some of the best I've been to.
Good to hear. Other comments?
If I can just add one thing out there, it's Lori Lundergan. If this is an opportunity, and I don't want to sign anybody up for anything, if it's an opportunity for some sort of a subcommittee to work with you, if there's a couple individuals who really want to see what a health checker might look like, if it's even just a quick dashboard or Excel file that says how you feel progress is and what your blockers are from that just one system, I'd be happy to join something like that or talk about something like that.
And for the record, Joe Dorian, we've actually had a few vacancies on our subcommittees, so we will. So instead of having the chair voluntold you to join, so I guess we have one. So, but thank you. And if anyone else is interested in joining, talk to me after the meeting.
Okay. Chase Eggerman, is there a list of subcommittees that
we can get that out?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Other comments? So.
Sorry, I was just taking notes.
No,
sorry.
That's fine.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we have the staff recommendation is to approve approval of the combined state plan as submitted within Attachment A. The requested action is approval of the proposed combined state plan as submitted within Attachment A. And we have, Mr. Chairman, a motion there that I won't read because I cannot make a motion, but we staff put together a draft motion if somebody is so willing to
move it as presented.
Okay. So second. Moved as presented. Second
I'll
by
second.
Chase.
Oops, sorry, something else.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Abstain?
Abstain.
The motion carries.
Now we have to submit in the system, so we'll let you know how it goes. And then 3B, which item 3B is topics for the June meeting. Given what we heard, do you want us to take the feedback and work on something?
That sounds good. I mean, I think that anybody who has any additional feedback or what you spoke about today, just I would email it to Joe and let him incorporate that into follow-up meetings.
And then 3C is just anything else that they want to
bring up. Yeah, anything else anybody wants to bring up? Okay, if there's not, is there a motion to adjourn?
I'll move to adjourn.
Move, second.
Sorry.
You don't have anything else, right?
Could you just say that so we don't get in trouble by DOJ?
For the record, this is George Kapatis. This concludes the duly noticed meeting for the State Workforce Innovation Board. This meeting has been recorded and was conducted in manner compliant with RSA 91-A. Please enter the recording. And what time? 11 past 2.
That's it.
Motion was made. Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.